Good morning. So, last time we went through this idea of having our processors run instructions out of order. We went through a possible kind of pipeline design with that, and we had these two big tricks that we were doing. So one is that, well, hazards became a lot more complicated, so we needed some nice way to figure out what FAT registers to forward and how to track what instructions might be ready to be executed and what aren't. And our mechanism for doing this was register renaming, that we'd have a bunch of physical registers that were more plentiful than the registers we saw in assembly, which we called architectural registers. And we'd rename all the architectural registers to some of these physical registers, and we'd give a separate name for each version. So if we were having multiple versions of R8 we dealt with in our code, each one of those would have its own register. This handled some cases where we found out, oh, it turns out we need to, have the old version around for one pending instruction, and we want to have the new version because that's the version we want to keep for future instructions. This let us solve that type of problem. So we kind of needed the support to store two versions at once anyways. And also it means that with these new names, because we make a new version each time the register is written, if we wanted to detect, do we have the right value, we just compare the register number, the new renamed register number. We don't have to do any reasoning about, is this really the most recent version of that, like we did in our pipeline processor. Then we talk about doing instruction dispatch on top of that. And what having these different register names allowed us to do is we could just have a table saying, which of the registers are ready right now? And our instruction dispatch is that we'd have this list of instructions waiting to run. We'd go through that list and say, okay, are the registers that this one needs listed as ready? If so, let's start it. And when we started it, well, we had a bunch of execution units to start it on. And often, these would be specialized. We wouldn't just have, two copies of our executing memory stage, or two or more, depending on how many instructions you wanted to run. We instead have an ALU, maybe an ALU that can handle our most complex instructions. We have our data cache, and we dispatch instructions to these based on what the instruction was doing. So for example, we might have several ALUs, but only one of them might be able to do a divide instruction. In that case, on a divide instruction, we'd only dispatch to the divide ALU. We might only have one slot that does a memory access, so those instructions would have to go there even though we had other execution units available. They just wouldn't be the type that could handle loads and stores. So then once we thought about how these processors worked, we looked back at, well, how does this affect how it executes our programs? And a big thing we discovered when looking at sort of what would happen when we did this instruction dispatch is that often we would have a sequence of instructions and we'd have plenty of ALUs and other execution units available and we wouldn't be able to use them. And the reason why would be that all the instructions that were pending were waiting for things to be computed, that our dependencies kept us from dispatching instructions. And this in particular was responsible for a mystery we saw last week, which was, why did loop unrolling stop helping us? Now, we did loop unrolling, and we couldn't get better than one cycle an instruction, even though our number of instructions run kept going down. So one cycle an element, even though our instructions run kept going down. And it turns out the reason for this is that, well, even as we had sort of fewer and fewer instructions to run, our processor needed to run the first add for the first iteration, the add for the second iteration, one after the other. We have this dependency. And we saw a pattern for fixing this, which I believe you applied in the lab yesterday, which is this multiple accumulators idea. There, by having two things we're accumulating into, we end up sort of breaking that sort of one after the other dependency. Now we can compute some one and some two at the same time in the loop. So this loop, if we have enough ALUs, can run twice as fast. Okay, So we had these performance results about that. So questions about things we covered last time before we start looking a little more at those performance results? Okay, so when we finished up last time, we had two mysteries in these performance results. So one was, why it went down to 0.57 and not 0.5. If we're doing two ads a cycle, and we got one out of cycle at one cycle with the, you know, non-multiple accumulators version, why do we get 0.57 instead of 0.5? That's one mystery. Another mystery was, what's happening down here? Where after we have four accumulators, why does the performance tank? You know. So sure, the processor I'm running this on doesn't have 8 ALUs, but we should still be able to do two ads a cycle, right? So what's going on? And to answer this question, it helps to look at the assembly that the compiler generated for these cases. And we can start with the 8 accumulator assembly to get an idea of what the assembly typically looked like when I was running my compiler. And you can see here that the compiler, it added one of the A of I plus 0, 1, I plus 0, A of I plus 1 to sum 2, A of I plus 2 to sum 3, and so on. Or, and you can see it kept sum 1 in RAX, sum 2 in RCX, sum 3 in RBX, sum 4 in R11, and so on. So it assigned a register to each of the sum variables. And this works for 8 accumulators. We have 8 of these sum variables. But if we think of how many registers we have, well, we have 16 registers, and we probably need to do things like keep track of our loop bounds and index. So with 16 accumulators, we're going to run out of registers. And that's, in fact, what happened. So the assembly that was generated for the 16 accumulator version stores some of the sum variables on the stack, which means we're doing extra data cache accesses, and that's why it got slower. And also extra instructions. And we also got to a place where, even though we provided extra things that could be done in parallel, my processor, it turns out, has around 4 ALUs that can do ads. So we were already well above what the processor could actually do every cycle as far as how much work we were giving it. And I say well above, not just a little above, because remember, we also have to have ALUs spending the time doing the work for like figuring out if we're done with the loop, and also we have to have ALUs do the work of computing these addresses here. So if I have 4 ALUs, it turns out I can do sort of a maximum of about 2 of these additions per cycle when I take into account the fact that I need to load the values and also take care of the loop. So that solves the mystery of why did 16 get so bad? It's because we ran out of registers, we were using the stack, we had just extra work to do that. But then it solved the mystery of the 0.57. So what was going on there? And if you think about that, it's worth thinking about what's going on in the loop where we'll start to do this loop with 2 accumulators. What is, or even 2 or 4 accumulators. So what's going on in the loop? And if I sort of count up the work the processor needs to do in the loop, for every element, I have to do 2 additions. I have to do an addition to add to the sum, and I have to do an addition to compute the address. So that's 2 ALU operations that the processor is going to end up doing. And then I also need to do my loop maintenance stuff. So what do I need to do for that? Well, I had this loop unrolled, so there were 16 copies of the loop body, and there was an add, subtract, and a compare for maintaining the loop index, that pointer to where we were in the array, and comparing to the end, and also a conditional jump. So I had four instructions in my loop that did 16 values that needed to use the ALU in order to, you know, do the stuff to make the loop work. And that means that for every actual sort of addition to the sum we were doing, I have to do a fourth of an instruction of work to maintain the loop. And that means I ended up doing 2 + 1/4 instructions per element of work overall. And if I look at how many ALUs my processor has, well, the answer was that my processor has, my processor had 4 ALUs. So this meant I could do this, that if the ALUs take one cycle to do all these operations, ALUs, and each takes one cycle. Each takes one cycle for add, sub, comp, etc. All these operations take one cycle on those ALUs. So I have 2 1/4 operations per element. If I divide that by 4, I get 0.57. So my performance, rather than limited by how many adds we could do at once, kind of as far as how many independent adds we had, was now limited by just how much work could we do in total. So it wasn't limited by dependencies anymore. It was limited by the actual capability of the processor. And this means that actually we could make this number get better. We could do better than 0.57. And the observation to make is that this +1/4 here, well, that came from my loop overhead now. That previously, the loop overhead didn't matter. When we only had one accumulator, the bottleneck was we have to do one add, then the other, then the other, then the other. Now, we have enough work that we always have something to do, but now the bottleneck is actually that we don't have enough space to do this loop overhead, so it would be worth reducing the loop overhead. So after I fix that problem, I can fix that problem by adding multiple accumulators, fix the problem of having to do one at a time. I can further speed things up by doing more loop unrolling, even though it wasn't helpful before. And we could, in fact, get kind of pretty close to 0.5 if we just unroll the loop even more. So questions about this? Yeah.
So when we just tried to do a bunch of loop unrolling, it ended up making it slower. If we just tried to throw more accumulators, it made it slower.
So the question, when we just tried to do a bunch of loop unrolling, it made it slower? So it didn't make it slower. So what happened with loop unrolling is we got this kind of plateau. So we got over that plateau by adding extra accumulators. When we did too much of that, it turned out we had problems with not keeping things in registers. But once we, as long as we're not doing that, that sort of, because it got us over that plateau, it exposed a place where more loop unrolling would be helpful. Other questions? So we have some upcoming homeworks, which are rotate and smooth. So I guess I'll probably say, I guess it's operations we talk about. So we have two homeworks, and if you look at the schedule, you may notice that rotate and smooth are both due together. So there's a smooth checkpoint, which is part one of smooth. We have found in past semesters that rotate is an assignment that is not as big as other assignments, and smooth is bigger, so that's why smooth is spread over 2 weeks, because it would be a bad idea for you to try to do the whole thing at the last minute which is what was happening. And also, it would be a bad idea to give people the impression, oh, rotate, that took me 30 minutes. It didn't take everyone 30 minutes, but took some people 30, some people had it done really quickly, and so assumed, therefore, smooth's going to be really quick, and they were wrong. So we want to spread that out. And these are both the assignments where you're going to be manipulating an image represented as a big matrix of pixel values. And our pixels are represented as things with four components, red, green, blue, and alpha, represented as single bytes. Alpha would be traditionally for transparency. I chose to have it in the assignment, so our sizes are multiples of four. And the way we access these is that this is conceptually a 2D array, but we're going to be accessing it using a single pointer and computing an index into this one dimension based on our x and y, using the formula, y times dimension plus x. And there's two little routines you're going to optimize for both the assignments, and the scoring is based on making them have a particular speed. And subject to some restrictions in the assignment, like don't break our timing code and things like that. You can do whatever works. And for the rotate assignment, that's basically how it's going to go, is that we're going to say, you need to figure out what would help performance here. And for rotate, what you're optimizing is doing a rotation of turning the image degrees, so we have a destination where we're doing an assignment to rotate it. And you might say, wait a moment, you're showing me the code here, and what's this Riddick's thing? So this is going to expand to dim minus 1 minus j times dim plus I. And I'll show you how that's defined exactly later. You'll have the source code for it. And similarly, this source I is going to expand to I times dim plus j. So it's just a shorthand for that, which you can use or not use, up to you. But the supplied code we give you does this. And this is a preprocessor macro, and I gather from past semesters that 2150 usually doesn't cover these very well, so we should talk about what preprocessor macros are, because there's just some things which might come up when you're trying to use them in C. So preprocessor macro is a text substitution, and in this case, you know, it's pound define, but rather than the pound defining something without any parameters, I have a parameter here. So I have a parameter x, and I'm saying double of x turns into x times 2. And this is a text substitution. So this is got done before the compiler actually works on this code. So the compiler first handles these preprocessor macros, then it compiles your code. So this is, in this case, this is going to become 100 times 2 before the code is compiled, meaning that the double will not appear in the object file at all. It's not a function call. It's like a find and replace in the code. And it's a find and replace in a very strong sense. So for example, I have that same double macro, and I just put in 3 plus 3. So that's going to expand into 3 plus 3 times 2. We just took this 3 plus 3, put it in place of x, and that's what we get. And that's going to give us, in this case, y equals 9. That is how these are defined to work. Maybe not best choice by the people who designed this part of C, but that's how it works. And because of this issue, what you'll typically see is that when people define these preprocessor macros, they're going to use what looks to you like extra parentheses. They are not extra parentheses. They are pretty required because of this sort of precedent situation. And that finally explains, this is how RIDIX is defined in the code of Arduino. Yes?
The previous two examples, do they both end up making y equal to 9 as well? And if so, is there any difference?
With the previous two examples, do they both end up making y equal to 9?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, this should be... I just didn't copy this properly. I see. And somehow no one noticed that on previous semesters. Okay. Thank you. Yes. So that should be 12 in that case. Yeah. Because it actually expands to that 3 plus 3, the quantity times 2. And it should be fixed double and not double. Yeah, but this is why, when you look at the code, there's these seemingly extra parentheses. They are not extra. They are required. If you want to do this sort of thing in your code, you should do that. You know, or I would usually prefer to try to avoid macros, but this is a kind of personal preference / style guide question. Okay, so as I mentioned, these assignments are going to be based, graded on performance. So some recommendations. Please, I would recommend not deleting stuff that works. The way the assignments are set up, you can supply multiple versions of the function, and we'll test multiple of them. Obviously, there's some sort of time limit, so don't like give us 1,000. But you know, you can have 10, 20 versions if you want. We're going to measure the speed up on my machine. So you can test in Portal and so on. I have a machine that should be running these submissions probably one at a time so they don't interfere with each other. And with some delay, probably depending on how busy that machine is and things like that, we'll show you the results there. And we have in the assignment, we describe what the machine is, but there. And because it's a certain speed up on my machine will have a different speed than like Portal and so on. Generally, I've found that things that are much faster on like Portal are probably much faster on my machine, but maybe not by the same amount. And which means that you should not assume because you don't meet the threshold on Portal, you won't meet the threshold on my machine and vice versa. And when things are kind of close in speed, there might be, the thing that might be faster on my machine might be not what's faster on Portal. That's not unusual. But part of what sort of mitigates this is that if you have multiple things you want to try, you can just submit a file with like 3 or 4 different things. And something to keep in mind is that you can, for general date, is that you should look at examples when we don't give specific advice. So for smooth, we have very specific advice. As I said, we're grading on performance, so if you can make smooth faster without following that advice, go ahead. But we have very specific advice that I think it is difficult to make the assignment faster without following at least a lot of it. Maybe not following it, but like doing the same thing over in the end. I would recommend, try techniques that seem acceptable. Make sure when you're trying something, vary the numbers. So like if you try cache blocking with one block size, maybe cache blocking is useful, but you just chose a block size that doesn't make sense or doesn't happen to work out. Same with loop unrolling or multiple accumulators. Maybe you decided to use 8 accumulators and you ran out of registers, but multiple accumulators are still useful, that sort of thing. And note that some techniques combine really well. We showed the example of loop unrolling and cache blocking. Loop unrolling, you kind of need to do if you want to do, if multiple accumulators are applicable, and so on. So questions on the upcoming assignments? Okay. So let's talk a little about compilers. So here I have a nice little sum function. And this sum function I have compiled here with GCC without optimization flag specified. So you can see that this does some wonderful things, and the kind of wonderful things that let us know that when people show us assembly like this, that they definitely didn't write it if they're submitting like an assembly assignment. you know, things you never do. Like, for example, this stores A, the pointer A, on the stack. Not, it just stores it on the stack, retrieves it, then does the add with an add instruction, then does the move. Like, that's how it retrieves something, it does an A of I. This, the code that's generated without optimization. So this is working code, but it does silly things. And it computes the offset with a separate instruction. It stores the sum on the stack. It stores I on the stack. It's accessing the stack using RBP instead of RSP, so we're wasting a register that we could use for perhaps something else. It does our condition check by reloading the thing we just stored. So without optimizations, compilers tend to generate bizarrely inefficient assembly. Like, not just slow, but like slower than the assembly you'd write by hand, not caring about performance. Because compilers do things like saying, okay, well, where do I put variables? Well, if I put it on the stack, that always works. So the default code often does that, even though you would probably start putting in a register, but for compilers, you know, they don't want to write the code that does that because they want to handle the case where they have like 100 variables. So they just have the default case do that and then optimize that away later. So usually I'd recommend compiling with optimization on. So here we have an example with optimization. So I have compiled here. This is optimize for size, if we look up what this flag means in the manual for GCC. And you can see it generates this nice compact assembly code. It uses registers for things. And has one instruction to do this entire statement because we were trying to make this nice and compact. So we did that. If I have it do the optimize level 2 here, this is trying to optimize for performance. And some of the things we did there weren't great for performance. And the big change it makes is that it does this transformation where rather than doing this A of I, it transforms this loop into having a pointer which starts at the beginning of A, and in the loop, it increments the pointer. And this means that it doesn't have to keep computing the array index every time, do the array index computation every time, which is a bit faster. That even though it's one instruction, it turns out that the processor executes the instruction of just access at this memory location faster than compute a memory location and access it. And so that's, you see, what the code it generates here. So even though this is more instructions, this ends up typically being faster, and that's what the compiler knows how to do. That's really nice, because this is not an obvious optimization for people writing assembly by hand. And if you've used GCC, you may know that, oh, there's like optimization level 3. Here I'm using a more recent version. And in this version, what does GCC do? Well, you may notice it's incrementing by 16. And you might say, so how is it incrementing by 16? Well, it's incrementing a pointer. So this is by, if we look at our original code, by 2 values. But then it has this one add instruction, this PADDQ, using this funny XMM2 register. And it turns out that x86 machines these days have an instruction that adds 2 pairs of longs at the same time in one instruction. And use that. We'll talk about this a little later, but just new to do that. And also to do that, it unrolled the loop. And if I supply optimization options to say, hey, optimize with this level 3 and also do it for my particular processor, it figures out, oh, well, the processor on my desktop, it supports this instruction which adds 4 pairs of things. And it uses that, unrolling the loop 4 times. And also there's this option to unroll loops, and it will just do that. There we go. Now the same code, but now with the loop unrolling. So now we're at, now each iteration of this loop adds approximately 32 longs in 8 instructions. And Clang, if I ask it to optimize and tell it to do Skylake, will do this thing already. And so a question you might have out of this is, if this is what compilers just do, assuming you figure out how to pass them the right options, why are we bothering learning about loop unrolling? And these other sorts of optimizations. So we're going to talk about things that compilers can do and can't do. And so compilers are good at different types of optimizations than humans. And there are kind of restrictions that will make compilers be bad at optimizing that wouldn't hurt humans. And some of these affect some of the optimizations we talked about. And we're going to try to focus on what those things are and what you have to do when that's a problem. And I'm going to say broadly, there are these four things we're going to talk about with things that restrict what compiler optimizers can do. So one thing, which seems kind of obvious, but is actually a bigger restriction than it sounds, is that the compilers need to generate code that does the exact same thing as what you wrote. And while that doesn't seem like a problem, well, of course, you know, when we're optimizing, we don't change what the code does. Problem is that compilers need to do this even in corner cases where you reading the code would say, no one's going to call the code this way. That's ridiculous. And so we're going to look at kind of the most common issue, which is this kind of corner case where compilers are going to have to be very careful to make the code do the same thing, where you'd look at the code and intuit, well, the code is not meant to be called this way. I don't need to worry about this circumstance. And this is a problem known as aliasing. So I have an example function here. So I've taken two pointers to longs. And I'm just adding the to the x pointer, the y pointer twice. And you might say, okay, so a way we could compile this is that we'll load the value of y, we'll double it in a register, and then we'll add it back to x. So that's my proposed way to compile this. And this seems like it should be faster because we're accessing x and y half as much, so we have half as many data cache accesses. This seems like something we want to do. The problem is that this code does not implement this function. That it is has it doesn't implement, not in the sense that I didn't follow the instructions sort of in the way they were written, it's in the sense that it will produce different numbers in x and y. And it's not at all obvious why this happens. Like, you intuitively would say, well, of course that's what this code does. And the problem is that I can be really mean in how I call this function. And how I can be really mean is I can call it with two copies of the same pointer. And if I do that, well, if we sort of expand what this function is supposed to do, this is supposed to be x plus equals x, after we account for the pointers being dereferenced. So that's going to multiply x times 4. So we should get 4 in x. But the version I wrote below says load, turns out x, which is star py, double it to 2, and add that to x, which is 1, to get 3. So this means that the compiler can't do this optimization that got rid of two cache accesses. It has to check. You know, it has to assume that RDI and RSI are the same pointer. And that's annoying, so it can't do that optimization that to us humans, we'd say, well, why would anyone call this function with two copies of the same pointer? Right, that doesn't make sense. That's not something the compiler can assume, because in the cases where it did matter, if that's what you were expecting as a human, you would be really annoyed if the compiler generated code that gave you the wrong number. Okay, I'd say this is a really contrived example, and it is, so let's do a less contrived example. So here I have a function where I have a matrix, and I just sum the rows of the matrix into an array. I have an array with a result for each row. So I just go through the rows, and I set my result and just increment it. And this has an aliasing problem. And in particular, the aliasing problem is that the compiler needs to worry that result is that we have set up a situation where we have result points to some memory and matrix points to something that kind of overlaps with it. The result and matrix are overlapping arrays. That's something the compiler needs to worry about. We looking at this function and knowing what it does would say, you'd be stupid to call the function that way. But what we wrote has a defined effect, if we call it, where we result is part of the matrix. And the compiler needs to implement that effect. Meaning, it can't do something we'd really like it to do, which is keep result of row in a register. We'd really like that to be kept in a register, not be written to memory every single time we do the add. But the compiler can't do that because it has to handle the case where we update that and we expect to read it back in this statement here. This is really annoying, but there's something we can do about it. We can make it, if we make that sum a local variable, it's easy for the compiler to see, well, there's no pointers to sum anywhere, so there's absolutely no way accessing the matrix could access sum. If we've never taken a pointer to sum, matrix definitely can't be a pointer to sum. And so it doesn't have to worry about it in this case. So for the bottom case, it can generate code that keeps sum in a register safely without doing any special work. And this will cause a difference in performance, in fact, because the compiler, this is the cycles per count per element with different n values. And you can see that I have the second version on the bottom here. It's a little bit faster with level optimization level 2. And if I do optimization level 3, it's a lot faster. And the reason why it gets a lot faster is that the compiler knows how to do things like loop unrolling and so on, and multiple accumulators and things like that, and in fact did some sort of multiple accumulators thing for this case, but it didn't know how to do it when there was this potential that we would read back a value we just wrote. And you might say, oh, well, couldn't the compiler detect this situation? And the answer is hypothetically yes. The compiler could generate code like this. It could generate code where it checks, is result overlapping with matrix? If so, do the fast version, otherwise do the slow version. It could generate code like this, but compilers typically won't do this. And if you think of sort of what this would look like, if the compiler generated this kind of if statement all the time, your executables would be huge. So it can't just do that every time. Maybe there's some way of making it make a good guess about when's a good time. This is probably a compiler's research question. But this is kind of a real restriction for the compiler. So what you'll probably want to do in practice is try to write code which helps the compiler out to know somehow that there's not this aliasing problem, so it doesn't need to keep storing things just in case. Okay, so questions? Missing. And so we talked about this aliasing problem, and this aliasing problem is one of the reasons why compilers are unlikely to do cache blocking for you. So here I have some code first we'll talk about aliasing in kind of a more general case. So here I have some code that does cache blocking, and we'd like to talk about two parts of aliasing and cache blocking. So first part we'll talk about with this slide is when we do cache blocking, how does that sort of kind of interact with aliasing and keeping things in registers? So if we think about this code, something we'd like to happen is we'd like that the compiler would load this into this A value into a register because we're using it again later. Even though, yeah, if we load it twice from the cache, it'll be hit both times. We'd really rather put it in a register because that's going to be faster. But the question is, can the compiler do that? And the answer is no. And it's no because just maybe this element of C here is the same address. So in order for the compiler to load A of I times N plus K into a register and not just load it from memory multiple times, it needs to prove that this element of C we're accessing is not the same thing. And generally, it's not going to do that because the way we prove that is like we have to add those if statements to say, oh, check if these overlap, if not, run the slow code. And probably the compiler's not going to do that for us, at least most of the time. But again, we could help the compiler out. So we can have a local variable that holds our values. And the compiler knows, well, I've never taken a pointer to that. Therefore, that's safe to keep in a register. I don't need to worry about that being the same thing as these Cs we're accessing later on. Because, well, it can't be. I've never taken a pointer to AI0K variable. And this idea is sometimes called register blocking. So we thought of cache blocking as, oh, I'm going to keep a block of values in the cache. Here I'm going to keep a block of values in registers. I'm going to help the compiler do that by keeping them in local variables. So hopefully the compiler assigns those local variables to registers. And hopefully I haven't done this with too many variables so we don't run out of registers. So questions on this idea? Yes?
On the previous slide, do you mind just explaining again
question is, why can't I keep this A value in a register? So if we kept this A value in a register, we'd like to do something like float temp equals this, and then use temp here and temp here, right? But if we did that, well, the temp value would be wrong if, in fact, this element of C was the same thing in A. And why would that be the case? Because like our C would point to something and our A would point to another part of the same big array, and the indices would just happen to match up. Okay. Other questions? Yeah?
So just to clarify for my sake, is it that if we end up modifying that value in C, if that happens to be the value in A that we then use next, then we wouldn't know?
So the corner case, if we had modified the value to say that happens to be the value of A, we wouldn't know. Yeah, so we wouldn't know unless we checked. So we'd have to add code to check or just always load it, store it to memory and load it from memory. Right, because our code here, even though I looking at this code know, okay, yeah, we don't really actually care what order we're writing things to C. It's well defined what the order should be, like if you're in a debugger and the compiler needs to implement that. Okay, so let's talk a little about, since we talked about aliasing, let's do a little exercise here. So here I have a function where I take two arrays, S1 and S2, add them together into an array D, and the compiler can't do this idea where, let's add the two values into two separate registers and then store them back, two separate local variables, and then store them into D. These are not equivalent. And what's an example of a call which would demonstrate that? through like summertime? Okay, so who thinks A would be a problem? B? C? D? Okay, so we have grid consensus on B, and most people say not the others, and I would say not the others. So I think the trickiest one of the, so I'll go through the ones that are not right, and we'll talk about why B is a problem. So for A, there's no problem because we're reading from A and writing to B. We're never going to write to something we're reading from, so we don't have to worry about things changing based on whether there's overlap between the two cases. Like, we're never, these S2 values aren't going to change based on anything that happens to D, so it doesn't matter what order we read them in, which is kind of a big change we're making here. Order relative to when we write to D. For C, we're going to read from B and A of 10, and then write to some things at the beginning of A. And you might say, wait a moment, we have some overlap between the things we're reading and writing. But in both versions, it's always the case that we don't read from something that we have written before, because we're always writing kind of A of 0 and A of 1 when we're reading A of 10 and A of 11, or writing A of 1 and A, 2 and A of 3, when we're reading A of 12 and A of 13. No matter what the version is, we're always kind of making sure we are writing only after we've read the value. So there's no difference. If that order changed, we'd have a problem. And in the case of D, even though we're all at both accessing A, because of the bounds on this loop, we never go beyond A1000 in what we read. So we're writing to A of 0 to A of 999, and we're reading from A of 1000 to A of 2001. And yes, there's overlap in the things we're reading, but just like in the case of A, that's not going to be a problem, because it doesn't matter what order we write things in if we're never writing something we're reading back. Questions on those cases? Yes?
Are we assuming that A and B are the same size?
We are assuming that A and B are large, are distinct and large. And by large, I mean large enough that them being not big enough isn't a problem. Does that answer your question? Okay, so as for B, what happens is that in the first case, when we think about how this expands, we end up, have the wrong arrow, we end up writing to something we immediately read. In the other case, we read the original value of that before it's modified. And so we get different answers from those two cases. So when we're computing, in this case, D of 1, which is A of 2, then we're going to be, in the first version, reading from the value we just wrote and adding that to itself. In the second version, we're reading the original version of the value, the non-overwritten one. So questions? Okay, scenario. Yeah?
So when we're trying to write code to kind of fix the aliasing problem, are you basically telling the compiler that these corner cases, I actually basically don't want to handle them?
So the question is, when I'm writing code to fix the aliasing, am I telling the compiler these corner cases that I want to handle? So that would be kind of ideal. But the fixes we've seen for aliasing are more of the form of, since the compiler can't figure it out, I'm going to tell it explicitly what things are candidates to put in registers. Or, if we're talking about cache blocking, since the compiler can't figure it out, I'm going to tell it that it can reorder these loops by reordering the loops to the correct way. So usually our fixes are not as satisfying as just telling the compiler, there's no aliasing here, I promise. Do I have backup slides for it? Probably not. So it turns out there's a keyword in C called restrict that is meant to tell the compiler what you said, I promise there's no aliasing here. When I've tried to use it, I have not seen it affect what the optimizer does very much. But there is a way of telling the compiler that. I'm just not talking about it much because I don't think it's very effective in practice, at least when I last looked. Maybe they've changed. So usually what you'll end up doing is kind of telling the compiler, this is the optimization I'd like you to do, essentially. Does that answer your question? Other questions? And so we looked at that example of aliasing, and we saw this kind of thing when we had these overlapping arrays. You know, sometimes we had these cases where, oops, we run into this problem where we need to be really careful about actually storing the values in the right order, not changing the order of our computations. And this is probably the big reason why those cache blocking and loop order changes are something the compiler probably won't do for you. Because if the compiler's worried about that type of aliasing where, you know, A, B, and C in this example are the same thing, or parts of the same thing, it probably can't do this type of transformation. That doesn't know it's going to produce the same answer. Okay, some questions? Okay, so earlier I showed you that an optimization that compilers are pretty good at doing, in the sense of mechanically they know how to do it, is loop unrolling. That loop unrolling is a very mechanical optimization. Like, applying it to a loop is pretty straightforward, and it's pretty straightforward to write code that transforms code to do loop unrolling. So why doesn't the compiler do it all the time? Why, in my initial example, did I need to tell the compiler to explicitly unroll loops? Why wasn't that the default for optimization level 3? You know, it wasn't the default in Clang. Why wasn't it the default in GCC? And well, there's a reason why GCC didn't make it the default. And that's that loop unrolling isn't always great. If I just unroll all my loops, then I'm going to have a bigger executable, and I'm going to have more instruction cache misses. My instruction cache is only so big. If I make my program big enough, I'm going to run out of space in that instruction cache and have more misses. And, you know, if we're actually unrolling loops that are very important, this isn't a big deal. But if I unroll every loop, and most of those loops have like 3 iterations, this is probably a problem. Probably just taking up a lot of space. And also, loop unrolling is slower when we have low numbers of root iterations. So if my typical loops have 3 iterations, and I unroll it to have 16 copies of the body, I'm going to be spending most of my time figuring out, oh, I'm in the leftover part, I need to do the special case. So I'm just adding code to check for cases that aren't happening. Like, it's just going to be slower. So loop unrolling isn't helpful if the loop isn't actually executed a lot, executed with many iterations. And that means that we want to do loop unrolling, but if you're a compiler, you want to unroll loops that are run a lot, so it's worth putting them in the instruction cache and taking up a lot of space in the instruction cache, and are quick to execute. You know, so it's worth unrolling them so we aren't copying a big loop body and, you know, sort of, and have enough iterations. And if we have a random loop like this here, where I just am checking if I is less than a variable and calling a function, well, it's really hard to tell, is this really worth unrolling? Is that variable typically like 2? And I'm just going to waste a bunch of space by having it unrolled? Does that function do something that takes like a second, so there's no point in unrolling it? The compiler really can't tell. So this is a reason why GCC decided that, you know, they're not just going to unroll all those loops by default, because a lot of the time it would probably hurt performance. And the other kind of issue is that sometimes, in some corner cases, the loop unrolling transformation is not so straightforward. So here, for example, so what's the problem with doing this transformation here? Why can't the compiler do that? That loop unrolling I just did. how would these two have different answers? So some function changed state elsewhere you don't know about. So what state would we be thinking of?
I don't know, like the global variable.
So like the global variable, yeah. So let's say if some function changes global variable, we have a problem here in that this transformation code said, oh, do I have an odd number of iterations? And that could change. And I could miss a call to some function that this code is supposed to do. So the compiler can't do this transformation in this case, just because the loop bounds are indeterminate. Unless the compiler does more analysis to figure out, oh, some function definitely doesn't change that global variable. But that information is not in this code. If the compiler is going to figure that out, it's going to need to do a much more complicated analysis, which maybe the compiler can do, but that obviously requires, for example, that it has access to the code for some function when it's compiling this. Okay. Questions? About this example. Yes, sorry.
For the prior example, could you explain how unrolling loops increases the likelihood of instruction cache misses?
How does unrolling loops increase the likelihood of instruction cache misses? So generally, we think of the instruction cache as like supposed to store the relevant part of our program. And when we unroll loops, we make that bigger. Like it's supposed to store the recent part of our program. And it only has a finite capacity. So if we unroll our loops, that part of our program that's accessed recently can become too big for the instruction cache's capacity. And that means later on, when we go back to some part of the program that we didn't access just now, we're more likely to have a miss. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So I talked about loop unrolling having these kind of downsides. And multiple accumulators has the same kind of downsides. It has all the downsides of loop unrolling because we kind of have to do loop unrolling for multiple accumulators to work. And it also uses extra registers, which means that if you're the compiler, you need to figure out, oh, having a register for this extra accumulator, that's going to help my performance more than putting other things we're using in the registers. And that's not an obvious thing because it depends on sort of doing a very careful analysis of what's the bottleneck in this loop, which especially if you're like you have a function call might not be obvious at all for the compiler. It might not be possible for the compiler to know. And so when the compiler has a loop like this, we could use multiple accumulators for this, but it's hard for the compiler to tell, would that make sense to do? Questions? So these are examples. I have my compiler limitation. So the sort of two thing other limitations compilers have that we've talked about with loop unrolling and multiple accumulators are that the compilers can't really tell when it has a loop, is this a loop with tons of iterations that's worth doing unrolling and multiple accumulators for maybe? Or is this a loop that's executed like 5 times? It can't tell that. That's a reason why it's not going to do these optimizations for you a lot of the time. And also, it can't tell when is it worth making the code much bigger, which, if we're just doing it and not changing the number of instructions we execute much, it's not going to do very much. It's just going to make it things slower. When is it worth making your program big to hopefully make it faster versus not? And that's going to depend on, is this actually code that's run a lot or is this code that's run rarely? So that's with loop unrolling multiple accumulators. So we're going to talk a little about some miscellaneous optimizations, some of which compilers do, and some of which, again, compilers will sometimes not do, but you could help them along. So here I have a loop here with a call to a function, and this is a pretty simple function here. And so we're going to add two numbers together. If they're greater than 10,000, we're going to return 10,000. Otherwise, we're going to return the sum. And I'm calling this in a loop. And if we think of what the function call for this loop does, we're going to have an instruction to move from the array into the appropriate register. We're going to have an instruction to move the sum into the appropriate argument register. And then we're going to do the call instruction, and then we're going to do the rep. So we've executed 1, 2, 3, 4 instructions to run this very call to this very short function that aren't really useful work. This is just bookkeeping. So like with loop unrolling, it would be nice to get rid of this bookkeeping. So with loop unrolling, we said, oh, there's this, all this bookkeeping of the index that we can avoid, and the same thing's true here. There's all this bookkeeping of arguments and return addresses that we're doing with these four instructions that we don't really need to do. So what the compiler could do instead, or you as an assembly writer could do instead, is you could just copy the code of the function right into the loop, making the appropriate changes to the argument register it's using to have it instead use RBX, parentheses RBX directly, to have it instead write to EAX, read from EAX directly to get the sum, and so on. And this is known as inlining. So we're inlining the function call. So rather than having the function call, we're putting the contents of the function where the call was, making the substitution so it works. Some questions? This code. So this is something the compiler could do, and you can also kind of do this manually and see, right? We could just put the function where it is, where it should go. Some questions? Here. So this is a very mechanical transformation like loop unrolling. And so you might say, okay, so the compiler could do this for us because it's mechanical, but also like loop unrolling, we'll find out that the compiler won't do it all the time because sometimes it's not helpful. So like it has the advantage, we are avoiding instructions, and we also let the compiler use more registers because we don't have to like worry about saving registers to make the function call and all that. But if we do this for every function call, well, now, you know, let's say we have a function that's called 100 times. Now we have 100 copies of that function. That's going to be worse for our instruction cache. We're going to have trying to fit more stuff in our instruction cache. We're going to have more misses because now their instruction cache is storing 100 copies of the function rather than one. So, as I said, this is something compilers can do. But there's two kind of issues they'll have. So one is that compilers are going to make a guess as to whether inlining is worthwhile. And usually, they make these simple heuristics that they say, we'll inline if it doesn't make the code much bigger. But they don't actually like inline and see how big the code is. Instead, they're going to say, OK, is this function big? If so, probably not worth inlining it. And sometimes they'll do it if the function's called exactly once, maybe they'll inline it because, you know, that's, they can only have one copy then and they're not spending extra space. But note that when they're saying, you know, if this is too big, they're saying, is it too big right now? They're not saying, is it too big after I do all my optimizations for this particular case? You're not going to check that. And a bigger issue is that compilers usually won't inline across object files. And the reason for this is, well, if I call the call to printf and I don't have the code for printf, well, I can't put the code for printf there unless I get the code first. So when we're making an object file, we don't have the code for stuff in other object files, so it can't do the inlining transformation then. So you can see that even when it does have the code, it's using these heuristics. So it's making some guesses as to whether inlining is worthwhile. And typically, compilers are going to try to be conservative because, well, it's better to have the code run slightly slower and not have our executable be like 10 megabytes than to inline all the time and have our executable become huge and slow because of that. Because not inlining, like, yes, it's slower, but it's not tremendously slower. Whereas the case of inlining all the time is going to make our executable a lot bigger. Okay, so questions about this inlining case? Okay, so one other kind of optimization special case to talk about is here. So what's slow about this curve? So this is a slow function, and there's going to be a fix. What's inefficient about this curve? And by slow, I mean this function has the wrong big O for what we're doing. Like, we can do this with a much better big O. Yeah?
Probably the fact that it's using string length.
Okay. And so what's the problem with using string length?
It's, like, we don't know the length of the string, so it could be, like, really big.
So it could be really big, and what does string length do to find the length?
Well, it's like an input, so, like, if you use the input, like, that's what makes the big O really big. Because it takes the base input down.
Yes, but the important thing, yes. So. Question, so you're saying, so the important thing is, yes, we're calling string length, and the problem with calling string length is that string length itself takes order n time, where n is the length of the string, that we don't, like, have the length of the string stored alongside it, we have to scan for a null character. And we're doing that, n times. So this ends up being, this code here ends up being n cubed, n squared, which is not really necessary. Yeah?
Wouldn't it just store it in a register?
So the question is, wouldn't the compiler just figure this out and store that in a register? So I like that idea. And this is what I would do if I were, like, writing this code by hand. The problem for the compiler is, the question is, why is the compiler going to treat this scenario differently than if I had foo of string? If you had foo of string, it's obvious you can't store it in a register, because what the heck does foo do? So in order for the compiler to store this in a register, the compiler needs to somehow have knowledge about how string len works. And it then needs to look at this entire loop body here and prove it doesn't change the string. And compilers usually won't do that for you, unfortunately. So this is an example of a case where it's very obvious to you what the optimization should be. You know, that, oh, if string len goes through the string every time, well, we can just store the result in a register, you know, store it in a local variable and use that again and again. But the compiler can't do that unless it has special knowledge coded in about how string len works. And it also proves that this code here doesn't modify that string. So I'm not saying it's impossible for the compiler to do that, but it often won't figure that out for you. So, you know, because this runs into the particular problem that it kind of requires looking in the source code for string len, but if we think about how things are typically compiled, we typically don't think of the compiler doing that. Questions? This example. So this is kind of a case of removing redundant operations. So this is something compilers can do, but sometimes they won't quite figure it out. So it's another case removing redundant operations. And here, my redundant operation is that I'm comparing I to n, I plus amount. I'm doing these two comparisons, which are kind of redundant. And something, so the reason they're redundant is I know probably amount is positive. And if I know amount is positive, what I can do instead is I know that if I plus amount is less than n, then I is less than n. So I don't need to do both of these checks. So I can rewrite this code to look something like this. And this is a transformation that I'm mentioning specifically because it comes up on the smooth assignment a little bit. And you might say, and something to observe about this is by doing this transformation, I just turn this into code that is a lot more regular, and therefore that I can apply a lot of the other techniques we talked about much more easily. Like doing loop unrolling on this code seems very annoying, right? Not so helpful. Doing loop unrolling on these is probably a lot simpler and will get us code that's kind of a lot more regular. And there's also other optimizations we'll talk about that are a lot easier on this code. Okay, so that's where we'll finish up today. So next time, we'll talk about one other big type of optimization, which is going to be vector instructions, which is something the processor is going to provide to us and that we're going to be using manually in the smooth assignment for the second part. Okay, that's where I'll finish up.